On this edition for Saturday, June 13th, President Trump addresses West Point's graduating class. Demonstrations for justice continue across the globe. And a surge in new coronavirus cases as cautious reopenings begin. Next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Bernard and Irene Schwartz, Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, Rosalind P. Walter, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments. Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Good evening, and thanks for joining us. There has been another questionable police shooting, this time in Atlanta outside a Wendy's restaurant last night. Videos from the scene are circulating on social media. This afternoon, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation said it is looking into the shooting of 27-year-old Rayshard Brooks by Atlanta police officers.
We have now seen full video from the Wendy's restaurant showing this gentleman entering into the video frame, running or fleeing from Atlanta police officers. It appears that he has in his hand the taser. You can see that at least to the naked eye. That's what it appears. He runs a relatively short distance. Looks like it's probably 5, 6, 7 parking spaces distance. And at that point turns around and it appears to the eye that he points the taser at the Atlanta officer. At that point, the Atlanta officer reaches down and retrieves his weapon from his holster, discharges it, strikes Mr. Brooks there on the parking lot, and he goes down.
As protests, marches, and rallies continue across the nation calling for racial justice and police reform, President Trump addressed the graduating class at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point today.
West Point, class of 2020.
More than 1,100 cadets assembled at socially distanced intervals. In the commencement address, the president made no specific references to ongoing protests or to the coronavirus pandemic. He praised the class of 2020, the Army, and the nation.
When times are turbulent, when the road is rough, what matters most is that which is permanent, timeless, enduring, and eternal.
President Trump gave in to pressure and criticism of his decision to hold a campaign rally in Tulsa, Oklahoma next Friday, June 19th, a holiday known as Juneteenth that honors the end of slavery in the United States. Just before midnight last night, the president tweeted the rally would be moved to Saturday, June 20th, writing, quote, "Many of my African-American friends and supporters have reached out to suggest that we consider changing the date out of respect for this holiday." The president is not changing the location of the rally. Tulsa, Oklahoma is the site of a massacre of African Americans by white mobs in 1921, one of the country's worst outbreaks of racist violence. Protests over the death of George Floyd at the hands of a Minneapolis police officer continued into its third weekend as local and state leaders take action to reform police agencies. In Minneapolis yesterday, the city council voted unanimously for a community-led public safety program to replace the police department. In Seattle, hundreds of protesters held a silent march yesterday in rainy weather, carrying signs and umbrellas. Protests have also led to the removal of statues of Confederate leaders from government buildings. In Frankfort, Kentucky today, a statue of the former Confederate President Jefferson Davis, who was born in the state, was taken down from the state capitol. A state commission voted to remove the statue and move it to a historic site where Davis was born. Protests against police brutality and racism, sparked by the killing of George Floyd, also continued today around the world. In London, Black Lives Matter protesters and rival far-right groups gathered for separate marches. Far-right groups converged at monuments boarded up to prevent vandalism and clashed with police after some threw bottles and cans at officers. Another Black Lives Matter protest in London was called off after organizers said the presence of far-right protesters would be unsafe. In Paris, thousands gathered to protest the death of George Floyd in Minnesota and of Adama Traoré, a black man who died after being pinned down by police in a Paris suburb in 2016.
the infantry.
To watch President Trump's address to the graduating class of the West Point Military Academy, visit pbs.org/newshour.
The protests set off by the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, Minnesota, are being led by a new generation of young activists, many who also want to bring more attention to the stories of police violence against black women. I spoke recently with Keisha Blaine, an associate professor of history at the University of Pittsburgh and author of Set the World on Fire, Black Nationalist Women and the Global Struggle for Freedom. Dr. Blaine, it seems as we have this national conversation that's been prompted in part by George Floyd's death, that there is something else that we're missing when it comes to an entire gender that's struggling with the same things.
Yes, I think so. In fact, many activists in the last few weeks have been pointing out the fact that even before the police killing of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor was killed by the police, an EMT worker in Louisville, Kentucky. And activists have been insisting that we really pay attention to this case. To this very day, the police officers who killed Taylor have not been arrested. And I think more and more people are certainly talking about Breonna Taylor, but that was just one example of how Black women's experiences are often sidelined in national narratives about American policing.
There was a whole Say Her Name campaign that was quite successful in trying to raise awareness of it, but it wasn't something that, and it still isn't something that creates the same kind of headlines. Why do you think that is?
Well, certainly I think the data reveals to us that the majority of Black people who are killed by police are young Black men. So in some ways, the focus on Black men is very much reflective of what the data tells us. But the truth is that there's also, I think, to a large extent, perhaps we might say sexism and even patriarchy, which is to say that the way people write about American policing tends to focus primarily on the experiences of Black men. And even as we recognize that most Black men are killed by the police, I think the key here is to tell the whole story. The key here is to make it clear that Black women and girls are also vulnerable to state-sanctioned violence.
What about the impact of the violence on everybody that's related to or connected to the individual, right? Whether they're mothers or sisters or daughters, that there is trauma that it's not just the one person that died that got hurt, so to speak.
Exactly. And we see that clearly with the recent case of Eric Garner. Within days of Garner's death, we saw his daughter, Erica, rising just on a national scene, pushing the issue, demanding changes in American policing. But the key here is that Black women are certainly affected. We can talk about trauma. We can talk about just the emotional turmoil that they go through. And it's not surprising then that they are often the ones at the forefront of the fight to bring an end to police violence and brutality.
And you literally have written the book on this, that being at the forefront of the fight is something the Black women have been doing for quite some time.
Absolutely. And my book, Set the World on Fire, focuses primarily on working class Black women and impoverished Black women. And I think that's key too, because many of the women who I talk about did not have much of a formal education. Many of them did not have much material resources. But what they did have was passion, and what they did have were their voices, and what they did have was the ability to just open up and explain what the problems were in their community, take to the streets and demand changes. And even when they didn't have access to the vote, at a time where Black women could not vote in the early 20th century, these women were still determined to make changes, to shape national politics and also global politics.
Keisha Blaine, Associate Professor, University of Pittsburgh. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
As cases of COVID-19 rise in many places around the country, some states are continuing to open as others pull back. At least 22 states are seeing increases in the number of confirmed coronavirus infections over the last 2 weeks, including Texas. Texas reported its highest daily number of COVID-19 infections this week, but Governor Greg Abbott said there's no need to ratchet back reopenings. Restaurants there were allowed to expand indoor dining from 50% to 75% yesterday. Arizona has also seen sharp increases in COVID-19 infections, with the daily number of cases more than doubling compared to mid-May before lockdown orders were eased. Officials in both states say healthcare systems have the capacity to handle the uptick in cases. But in Utah and Oregon, officials said they were putting future reopenings on pause to assess upticks in coronavirus cases. As other parts of the country see rises in COVID-19 cases, some early hotspots like New York City continue to see decreases in the daily number of new virus infections. New York City has now started the first phase of reopening, allowing an estimated 400,000 people back to work in industries like construction and manufacturing. But as Christopher Booker reports, areas outside the city that were also hit hard by the pandemic are even further along.
Nick Triscari is happy to welcome customers to his brand new outdoor space at the Wooden Spoon, the restaurant he owns in downtown New Rochelle, even though he's still putting the finishing touches on the space. The sun umbrellas aren't even scheduled to arrive until Monday.
For the last, 100-something days, we've been, working out of our comfort zone, really, just not having customers in here, transitioning into a takeout restaurant, which we weren't originally open to be. But it feels great to actually have customers in here again.
As of this past Tuesday, outdoor dining in this region just north of New York City is now allowed as part of phase two of its reopening. Restaurants are required to space tables 6 feet apart, and workers must wear masks. Triscari, who also works full-time as a New Rochelle firefighter, came down with COVID-19 himself in April. He says he's taking every precaution he can for his customers and his family.
My mother works out front. My wife helps out here. The last thing I want is any of them to get sick, so we're taking it serious.
We were here nearly 3 months ago after New York had opened its very first drive-through testing facility. New Rochelle was one of the early epicenters of the coronavirus pandemic, and the testing facility is still open. But for some of the city's businesses, things are looking different than they did during that mid-March weekend.
At EM Barbers, Vinny Aiza is cutting hair again. He reopened this past Tuesday and allows one client into the shop at a time, scheduled in advance.
How busy have you been since Tuesday?
I've been pretty much booked since open to close.
Aiza applied for the federal protection program, but was denied. He says he was able to make ends meet in part by collecting unemployment benefits.
I'd rather just get back to work, and I don't want to collect nothing.
How are you?
A few doors down, workers at the North End Tavern are putting out tables and chairs, measured exactly 6 feet apart for social distancing. Jerry DeJesus is one of the owners and the executive chef.
We've been living off the to-go's and deliveries and curbside pickup and Uber Eats, and that just wasn't cutting it, to be honest with you. So it's kind of nice to have tables and have people come in and actually eat.
These two businesses are just down the road from the Young Israel Synagogue, which emerged as a hotspot in early March. This led to a local lockdown, with New York Governor Andrew Cuomo mandating a one-mile containment zone, which included this stretch on North Avenue. Just over a week later, on March 22nd, the one-mile zone became irrelevant as the entire state went on pause, with all non-essential retailers and businesses ordered to close. Now, nearly 3 months later, this region is on track to enter the next phase of reopening in the coming weeks. New COVID-19 infections in this county have fallen by nearly 95% from a peak in late March. That means there could be indoor dining, at least at 50% capacity, by July. Wooden Spoon owner Nick Triscari says whether people are sitting outside or inside, he's just happy to have people come to his restaurant again.
Not to be dramatic here, but the fact that we're open now, whereas I thought that really we weren't going to have customers in here until September, I wouldn't say borrowed time. I know that's probably not an appropriate term, but successful is just being open and having customers come in here.
A new outbreak of coronavirus cases in China has put a district in Beijing into what authorities are calling wartime mode, with new lockdowns in place. A 52-year-old man hospitalized on Thursday with coronavirus symptoms had visited a major seafood and produce market in early June. Contact tracers are working to test the 10,000 people who work at the Xinfadi market. So far, they have found 45 new cases. Beijing had gone 55 days without a locally transmitted case of the coronavirus. And in Brazil, the country's coronavirus death toll is now the second highest in the world, surpassing the UK, with nearly 42,000 recorded deaths. Controversy arose there earlier this month when the government stopped publishing some COVID-19 data, including the number of coronavirus deaths. A judge overturned the decision days later. I spoke with New York Times reporter Ernesto Londoño in Rio de Janeiro about that and more on the COVID-19 crisis in Brazil. So the president decides not to publish the coronavirus numbers. How do the people react?
People reacted with outrage. You know, experts found it inconceivable that a country that has now emerged as the epicenter of the epidemic was playing fast and loose with the numbers and was questioning whether the numbers presented an accurate snapshot of the epidemic. You know, if anything, healthcare experts think that the official tally undercounts the number of coronavirus deaths and cases in Brazil. You know, we're at a point where more than 40,000 people have died. There have been more than 800,000 confirmed cases. And this is in a country that has had very limited testing and where the trend lines are still tracking upward. The government was forced to reinstate the old way it was counting deaths only after the Supreme Court weighed in and ordered it to do so.
Now, how much of this is politics? Because you kind of see Brazil following many of the steps of the United States. Our trend lines are going up, but we're also reopening. There are images that I see of shopping malls and people going back to life as normal in Brazil.
Absolutely. I think politics looms large for all elected officials who have a hand in dealing with this pandemic. And what we've had essentially is a tug of war between the president and governors around the country that have tried to promote quarantine. I think what all elected officials are asking themselves is, when the economic toll really starts to bite, who is going to be blamed for the steps that were taken? And I think the president on some level believes that the governors can take the brunt of the political hit and he can emerge as the leader that expressed throughout this crisis the most concern for people's welfare, for jobs, etc. He continues to this day to downplay the severity of the pandemic and to make claims that are, you know, pretty preposterous in the eyes of many of his critics. For example, on a recent video live conversation that he had with supporters, he said that people should take to the hospitals, should sneak into the hospitals to film what is truly going on, which, you know, doctors obviously think is supremely dangerous, to encourage people to sneak into hospitals at a time when doctors are trying to contain this pandemic.
One of the other stories that you did this week was kind of interesting, is that the deforestation crisis that Brazil's been facing for quite some time now has actually picked up pace during the pandemic. How?
I think what has happened now is, with all the eyes of the world and the politicians being consumed by the healthcare crisis, the state has had very limited ability to control what's going out in very remote areas. So illegal loggers and illegal miners have been able to stride deeper and deeper into the rainforest. The government is aware of this, and it set in motion a military response, but most experts think it's going to be insufficient to truly rein in the driving forces of deforestation, which is expected to reach pretty alarming levels this year. Experts are predicting that the fire season this year is going to eclipse what we saw last year.
All right. Ernesto Londoño from the New York Times joining us from Brazil. Thanks so much.
Always a pleasure.
Last year, NewsHour Weekend profiled the unique resilience and persistence of Dr. Jean-William Pop in Haiti. The doctor has been on the front lines of Haiti's ever-changing public health needs and climate disasters, from the early days of the AIDS epidemic to the devastating earthquake in 2010. Now, as Haiti confronts a massive uptick in coronavirus cases, Dr. Pop is using that past experience to fight what is quickly becoming another health crisis in this fragile nation. NewsHour Weekend correspondent Yvette Feliciano has more.
Based on the last time we spoke with you last year in Haiti and learned a little bit about your history there, you've been on the front lines of the height of the AIDS epidemic and the earthquake aftermath and subsequent cholera outbreak. You know, how reminiscent is this moment and how much are you employing that knowledge right now?
This type of knowledge is cumulative and it gives you huge experience. For instance, you know, it's been very difficult to convince many people, many Haitians, that COVID is real. So essentially what we had to do is go in any community and then we asked them to give us people that we could train as community health agents. We trained them to sensitize their people, their population, where they live, about the disease, and to bring us anybody they feel have signs or symptoms associated with COVID. You win that community immediately because poor people are not stupid. Poor people want to make sure that what you're telling them is real and what you're telling them is good for them.
But over the past few weeks, Haiti has seen a rise of more than 600% of COVID-19 cases.
We have a lot of Haitians leaving the Dominican Republic to return home, about 30,000 of them. And as you may know, the Dominican Republic has the worst epidemic in the entire region. They have passed the bar of 20,000 cases. So it's a huge epidemic. So we believe that those Haitians coming back, they are the one now accounting for the disease spreading at a rate of 200 new cases every day. We have essentially have 24 more times the infection rate that we had 3 weeks ago.
In addition to community outreach strategies educating Haitians about COVID-19, Dr. Pop says large-scale treatment centers are being set up around the country.
We strongly believe that if we have enough patients who come in on time, they don't wait too long, we can save all of them. The tragedy has been young men in their 30s and some even younger who waited too long. And at that time, there is not much we could do for them.
But with about 21,000 tests for a population of 11 million, some doctors worry that Haiti is not testing enough people.
With only a limited number of tests, you know, how accurate are the official numbers of COVID-19 cases in Haiti?
What we've been doing is what is recommended by WHO, is essentially to test people with signs and symptoms. Nobody tests an entire population. So if somebody has signs and symptoms of COVID, he's going to be tested.
So far, the Haitian government has tested less than 11,000 suspected cases. Dr. Pop says officials also haven't strictly enforced the national lockdown because for many Haitians, a day spent at home is a day without food.
The government has made some efforts to provide subsidies to families, but it's not sufficient. So I am most afraid of the after COVID than the COVID itself, because even if all lockdown has not been implemented in Haiti, businesses have decreased a lot. Remittances from the diaspora have decreased by 30%. And the factories that are exporting to the US have slowed down tremendously. We worry also because this year we've had a drought. So it's going to affect our crop at the end of this year, creating more hunger. And at all times, we have 40% of people who don't eat properly. So imagine that this is going to get worse.
In addition to the economic toll of the health crisis, Dr. Pop is also concerned about hurricane season, which began just this month. He worries a big storm could make the COVID-19 outbreak even worse.
When it rains badly, people die, houses are destroyed. If you're putting people in some temporary shelter, you cannot have them too close one to another. because you'll create an expansion of the COVID epidemic.
I want to ask, how are you feeling personally in this moment?
Well, I think it's the toughest crisis I've been through. Essentially because it's coming at the worst time for us. At a time when we have five other major problems that would need a chapter on their own. So it's the accumulation of problems that make it a perfect storm.
That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. I'm Hari Srinivasan. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and have a good night.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Bernard and Irene Schwartz, Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, Rosalind P. Walter, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments.
When it comes to wireless, Consumer Cellular gives its customers the choice. Our no-contract plans give you as much or as little talk, text, and data as you want. And our U.S.-based customer service team is on hand to help. To learn more, go to consumercellular.tv.
Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.